So I would begin by reading the opening of this novel. The novel is in two parts. Part one is called The Undertaking. And part two is called The Heights. But I thought I'd read the beginning of the first chapter, which is called Woodlock and Sons. I don't think I've ever read it out loud sitting down. But I think that's what I'm going to do. It'll be okay. Woodlock and Sons. Silas Woodlock was the end of the line, so far as he was concerned. There would be Ashley, of course, but then that was it. The entire tradition since 1869, kaput. Not that the same building had been home all that time. Still, the sense of history was there. Order, continuity, passing on the baton. One generation to the next. Now it was over. Enough was enough. Things had taken their toll, especially after the scare with Ethel last winter. If you could call it winter. Primroses popping up in November. Spring warmth at Christmas. Catch it in the corner of people's eyes. Day after day, unseasonably mild, as the forecasters like to say. Imagine the fellow on the weather coming clean. Good evening. Once again, it was a worryingly unnatural sort of a day. Nothing any of us are used to. A day out of sorts with the days we used to think of as days. Days and confused, ha-ha. Day after day, clement without clemency. Try that. Followed by downpours and flash floods, then bitter weeks of ice and snow, then plunged again into days too mild to be remotely realistic. Sunday family roast back in the day, cold fire flickering, windows foggy with condensation, clip round the ear if they caught you finger writing, dad at the head of the table and mum bringing in the dishes one by one, steaming hot, and everyone settled and the rest, even the cat and dog, appreciating the order of ceremony. Then the moment impatience became acceptable, the mutts, eye whites under the table, the plaintive, semi-smothered, yelping for a bone and pussy in the wells, tortoise shell arched back and as if electrocuted tail curling stiffly through the blind spinny of human legs. And after saying the grace which never failed to happen at that repast, his old man, very formal, as if he had never enunciated the words before, asked, "Would someone be so kind as to supply the seasoning?" And Silas and his sisters never thought to wonder what the seasoning was, only something they had to pass down the table for the father to shake out over his roast lamb and veg. It was the old man's own special mix their mother wouldn't have touched with a barge pole, salt and black pepper, rosemary and thyme and other stuff that got stuck in his teeth. Always had to have it with his roast. But Silas couldn't see what seasons had to do with it until the last year of school when they studied Shakespeare and Lady Macbeth says to her husband, "You lack the season of all nature's sleep." He could imagine that on his headstone, as a matter of fact. Not that he'd have Ash or Ethel, no, but he could picture it, quite poetical, better in the last resort than a line of Latin, fond as he was of that dead tongue. Did Macbeth have the first clue what his worse half was saying? "You need some shut-eye is what you need, darling." The drift was obvious enough. You lack the season of all natures. Did it matter that no spouse in real life ever uttered such words to their soulmate? The important thing was that it sounded simple and said more than you could easily ponder. The important thing, he remembered his English teacher saying, was that Shakespeare might have meant season in the sense of a period of time, or he might have meant season in the sense of salt or spice and the rest, but it didn't matter what he meant because we were never going to find out. And in the meantime, there was life to live and this magnificent line, "You lack the season of all natures, sleep." Fit for a headstone, possibly, but a bit screwball, Silas eventually conceded. Like a message from the grave, from the dead to everyone still living, a blanket statement to the effect that everyone is suffering from sleep deprivation, or as if sleep were the name of a person, as if it were an inscription addressing sleep itself, as if sleep lacked all due season. Sleep, you're out on a limb, mate. You've lost all sense and reason. Or then again, the statement could be referencing the one who had passed on, inverting the soporific stereotype, called away at the end of the day, exquisite corpse, the ultimate night-night, gone to sleep and the rest. No, you, in the ground there, you lack the season. It's so far past your bedtime, you're never going to sleep again. This is it. From now on in, sleep no more. No more shut-eye forever. In any case, It was over. Past the seasoning, seasons passed on. Farewell, Vivaldi, seasons no more. And therefore being rushed into hospital was the wake-up call.
In your book, How to Read Shakespeare, you write, how to read Shakespeare is a question of how to think about wordplay. And that in Shakespeare, wordplay precedes character. Go on. One of the most immediate and profound things about Shakespeare's work is the sense of his love of language, a sense of playing with words and of the amazing, terrifying things that they can do. Words in Shakespeare seem to take on an autonomous life or machine-like power. They're like little search engines, meddling imps, strange creatures with wills of their own. I think everybody can see from the little bit that Nick read how absolutely integral to his writing is the idea of wordplay. But I just want to begin by picking up on an apparently ordinary phrase in this. I want to ask you, Nick, what do you think it means to love language?
That's a simple kind of question.
I want to start simply.
Yeah. I suppose it's impossible to think about that question without thinking about Cordelia and the impulse to be silent or to think that one should be silent or to say that one should be silent. And I quite like to hold on to Cordelia in thinking about this question because I suppose silence in Shakespeare, at least in King Lear, in the context of love and in that moment, comes to be inscribed, it seems to me, with the kind of force that it has in Freud's Beyond the Pleasure Principle. When Freud says that the death drive works in silence. Love is something that one might want to be silent about, but Eros, as Freud also says in Beyond the Pleasure Principle, is really something chattery. And I can't imagine writing about love without writing about language. Partly for that reason, partly also, I suppose, because I think in a complicated and perhaps troubling way, speaking of love is, as Lacan says, itself a jouissance and is indissociable from naming, especially from naming love. And I suppose everybody here has some familiarity with the experience of somebody saying I love you to them, and that I love you being not simply a statement, of course, but what Austin calls a performative. Something happens in language when you say that. It might be the most exhilarating thing anybody has ever said to you. It might also be the most terrifying, but it's something that happens.
In your novel, there are many kinds of writing and many kinds of writing about writing. And It seems to me, in a way, without being too schematic about this, that there's something in the English Guide that follows on from the first novel you wrote, Quilt. It's a very, very extraordinary book. And the afterword of the novel itself has two passages about the novel, which I want to read, partly just because they're so wonderful, and partly because I think they set something up that's in and written about in the English Guide. This is Nicholas's first novel, Quilt, which you may or may not know. It is an amazing book, and it has an afterword written by, as it were, the narrator or the author. But it's talked about partly as a question, what is the nature of an afterword to a novel? And there are various things said, some of which you might think of as coming from an ordinary book of literary criticism, but also a sense, as I often have with Nick's writing, that there are lots of kinds of writing informing any apparent genre piece that he writes. So there's a kind of very complicated resonance in his writing. So it's not entirely clear who's speaking here, but I want to read you two paragraphs from the afterword. The afterword is called Reality Literature, clearly an allusion, as he says, to reality television. A novel has to do what it has always done, tell a story, give pleasure, compel and surprise us. But the situation of the novel today is singular and unprecedented. It faces challenges and pressures unimaginable in earlier times. It's difficult not to think of writing a novel as an offensive, at best risible instance of fiddling while Rome burns. In other words, while a world war rages all around, with the control and ownership of Jerusalem at its heart, more of the world's population than ever before live in poverty and hunger. Women, more or less everywhere, continue to be positioned as inferior members of the human race. The environment of the planet is being systematically and rapidly destroyed, and non-human animal species are being wiped out daily. How is the novel to respond to this while trying to do what it has always done? What are a novelist's responsibilities in this context? That's, as it were, one voice. Then the second voice in an English Guide, and this is again from the afterword, and links to what Nick's been reading. The novel has to make trouble in and with language. It must meddle. The novelist has to aspire to a writing that figures and insists on strangeness, on what cannot be appropriated or turned over to the language police. The novel has to resist and, as far as it can, interfere with the smoothly neutralizing, nulling flow of the program. It must strive for English to appear in its most pristine form as what it always was, a foreign language. It would thus urge a new experience of that language, inviting readers to feel for themselves the strangeness of this English, which, after all, belongs to no one. Meddling and strangeness, however, should not be confused with calculation and coldness. The novel must also be a work of love, which means speed. It means moving, in Shakespeare's words, quote, with wings as swift as meditation or the thoughts of love. In an English Guide to Birdwatching, there is a character called Stephen Osmer, who is a kind of aspiring literary journalist, and in a way literary critic and cultural critic. And the novel, in a way, one of the things, and the novel does very many things, but one of the things the novel does is stage a kind of conflict or a debate. So between an interest in wordplay, if you like, set against, sometimes, an interest in what used to be called engaged literature. That's a politically committed and engaged literature. So Stephen Osmond, for example, at one point in the books, criticising a writer called Nicholas Royal, who is and isn't with us tonight. Stephen Osmond writes that his writing has two glaring and profound flaws, a hopeless overindulgence in wordplay and a complete absence of proper historical research. And later in the book, we're told that Stephen has, quote, a deep-rooted distrust of wordplay. In writing this novel, were you aware of wanting to, as it were, explore or investigate this conflict between the pleasure of wordplay and what might be called a certain kind of love of language, juxtaposed with or alongside a belief that literature should be doing something in the world, that's something to do with justice.
Yeah, I mean, a good friend of mine, still a good friend, read Quilt and read Reality Literature and said to me, you know, I love both of these texts, but what does the second one have to do with the first one? What does Reality Literature have to do with this novel? And for me, you know, being the innocent author, I hadn't really thought about it as an issue, but you know, it sent me away to reflect, and I suppose it impelled me in part to feel I need to write something that is doing what I want the novel to be doing. So, in some ways, there was the sense for me of attempting to think about that responsibility that you were referring to. But at the same time, and this is the obvious kind of double bind or abyss of writing, when one writes, I think, certainly when I write, you're not responsible. You can't be responsible. And there's a little essay which I love, and I find myself referring to far more often than perhaps I ought to, by E.M. Forster, called Anonymity, An Inquiry, from 1925. I don't know, probably nobody here has read it, but you can Google it, I'm sure, read it speedily. But it's a lovely, short essay about the idea that literature is really about anonymity, and it's about letting buckets down into the unconscious. And this is a, you know, it's a simple text, but it's an inspiring one, I think, for describing, I suppose, the way in which I think about writing. And for me, writing the novel, I could only really do it before I'd woken up. You know, so, I mean, there are various references to the hypnagogic in the text, and in part they are, I suppose, corresponding to this fact that I can write when I'm not conscious. You know, that's the best for me. And then, of course, it's a complete mess, and it has to be improved as best it can be, and made intelligible, made less unreadable or whatever. But that was the real kind of, yeah. I suppose, the pressure in writing for me, while wanting the book to be about what we are all, I think, profoundly disturbed by in the world now. Mm. You know? So Osma, in his osmotic way, is a character who I hope allows for the articulation of some of those issues of social justice and so forth. Mm. And then questions about climate change, which I also see as being, you know, completely unavoidable for thinking about writing today, find voice in the text in different ways, partly through characters, but probably above all through the fact of species extinction, and the birds already no longer with us, the birds that are disappearing year by year.
I mean, I think in a way, and you write about this as well as virtually everything else in the guide, conversations like this easily lead one to believe that a piece of writing is in some sense calculated. And I think what's difficult about conversations, at least I find difficult when I'm the other side of it, so to speak, is that in a way there isn't any more book. I mean, the book's in the book. There isn't more book in me or in you. We can talk about it, but it's not more book. And in a way it seems to me the book is very much about, I mean, when you talk about referring to the Forster buckets into the unconscious, it's obviously a very vivid visual image, but it's also a very strange image in a way, isn't it? Because that in itself has an intentionality to it that writing often doesn't feel like it's got. And one of the characters in your book, Lily, is interested in film, in what she calls the transformation of intention. And it seems to me a lot of your writing is about something to do with that. Given we are in the Freud Museum, it seems to me that there is an obvious link between wordplay and engagement, which is free association. In other words, Freud, I mean, you don't need me to tell you this, but not anybody here, but Freud invented a therapy that, in a sense, used wordplay as, in his view, the most profound form of engagement with historical truth. That it was actually through free association, through puns and ambiguities and so on, that, as it were, a realer or a more unconsciously viable form of historical truth is engaged with. Now, I don't know if, I mean, another amusing and interesting thing in your book is that, of course, Stephen, one of the heroes, hates psychoanalysis. And indeed, he became famous in literary London for his disparagement of psychoanalysis. And there's a character in one of the characters at a rather wonderful party in this book called Armin May, who's interested in Ferenczi. So things are being seeded throughout the book about psychoanalysis without psychoanalysis being in any sense particularly gone into. Do you feel as though psychoanalysis as a writing is an informing presence in your writing?
Of course I do, yeah. I did when I was sort of scribbling some notes this morning think, should I draw up a little inventory, but that became as absurd as trying to categorise the uncanny. So I'm not sure where I would begin with thinking about Freud above all for my thinking and for my writing.
Do you have a sense of what reading psychoanalysis has done to you?
I think the short answer to that question would be I've started work on a new novel this summer. I think it is a new novel, and it's about my mother. And one of the things that I found myself writing about already is what I shared with her about psychoanalysis when I was a teenager.
Was she interested in psychoanalysis herself?
Not really, no. Except that she was interested in anything. You know, she loved reading and she would enthuse about whatever I was reading. But I think we came at it through Lawrence. So I don't know, I can't imagine my life without psychoanalysis. I mean, let's take Silas and Ethel. You know, the opening of this novel. There's a whole question about point of view, and the couple of pages that I was reading out might be described as, in one way or another, coming from Silas's point of view. But I don't believe, in fact, that there is any point of view in novels. I think point of view, like omniscience, is a critical fiction. And I think what happens in novels is much more akin to telepathy and other forms of magical thinking. So wherever you have something like what, as it were, a traditional critic might call so-and-so's point of view, it's never simply that character's point of view, it's always a voice within a voice, it's always more than one who's feeling, thinking, articulating. So for me, for many years, going back to The Uncanny, the book called The Uncanny, which I published in 2003, and earlier, I have been, my first book, Telepathy in Literature, I have been fascinated and I would say in some ways obsessed by the question of telepathy in relation to literature and in relation to Freud, because of course it was something which, as he said to Ernest James, drove him to the point of distraction. It was one of the great bugbears or fascinations of his life. So the beginning of the novel is already about Freud for me. It's very much about the nature of telepathy, magical thinking, and the emergence of Macbeth in the early pages. I mean, it's so difficult to... I mean, obviously I didn't write it thinking, I'm going to plant this here and I'm going to... But Macbeth is a really important play for the novel. At least two reasons, it seems to me. One has to do with the idea of the time of an event. The deed is done, but when is it done? And the other has to do with a phrase that Freud uses in his essay, Some Characters Met Within Psychoanalytic Work, which it's when he talks about Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, and he straight sheet translates this as that they're not two separate characters. They are, Freud says, two disunited parts of a single psychical individuality. And I think that's such an insightful remark about Shakespeare's play and about how something like the telepathic or magical thinking is at work in Macbeth. And for thinking about how to explore character or to write about a married couple, such as Silas and Ethel. So they're deeply Freudian. In that sense.
One of the, to me, most interesting versions of the telepathy question in your writing is to do with the relationship to non-human animals. Because both in the first novel, there is, again, the Asgore hero has a relationship with stingrays, which he keeps. There are extraordinary descriptions of rays. In the English guide, there is this reference throughout the book to bird life, and to both the temptation to anthropomorphise bird life, but a sense of bird life as it were, uncanny or strange or remote in some sense, and very present. Essentially, there's a continuing oscillation in your books between things being too present and things being too absent, as it were. And one of the things I think you write wonderfully about is not only people looking at animals or birds, but animals or birds looking at people. As though this is like a scenario in which something is being exchanged that may be indiscernible, but that's incredibly powerful. As though these are real communications, even if they're not as well articulated communications. It seems to me in both books, there's always an interest in sounds that are not simply words. And so it's as though one of the things that's being worked at or around here, I don't know if you would even want to put it like that, would be something to do with the sense in which, you know, the inhuman in the human, that something has been humanized, but nevertheless we're creaturely. And that in both the books there's a very, very, I mean, it is like the cry of the heart against necessity. Very, very powerful, heartfelt despair about the murdering of the non-human environment. And there's a very, very powerful bit in the English guide about the killing of chickens. Now, of course, millions of people have written about this, you know, chickens in concentration camps and all this stuff. But it's amazingly powerful in this book. Partly because, I think, there's a real sense of the way in which chickens have been rendered absurd. So we are, as we're amused by this, and yet it is true that millions and millions of chickens, as we speak, are being killed now, and all the time. And these, of course, these are easy facts to sort of nod to, and very hard facts to imagine, to properly imagine. So it seems to me something about the non-human environment is very powerful here. And what it made me wonder was, how much relationships with animals have been significant in your life growing up?
Is that a psychobiographical question?
Yes. Yes and no.
It's impossible for me to think about non-human animals without thinking about mourning. And this is in part because the novel, An English Guide to Birdwatching, is dedicated to the memory of my brother who died of a horrible cancer when he was 26. And he was a painter, very talented, very gifted painter, but he was also a bird lover and he kept birds. So for me, a lot of my interest in birds is inseparable from him. He kept birds which I think now you wouldn't be able to keep, you know, like Gaia falcons, you know, quite big birds. Kestrels and owls and so forth. So, you know, when I was starting to read the novel, I started supposedly on page one, but for me the novel begins with Catullus and with his poem 101, as it's called, which is there in Latin in the dedication. But also with Wordsworth and Home at Grasmere, and the way in which Wordsworth writes about birds, particularly a murmuration. I think Wordsworth is one of the poets who is always writing about loss when he's writing about birds. And there's a very good book which was published, you know, probably about 20 years ago now, called Electric Animal, by a Japanese-American critic, Akira Lippitt, I think his name is. And he has a very striking phrase in the opening of his book where he says, you know, the non-human animal is perpetually vanishing. And I suppose what I'm interested in trying to capture in my writing is something like that phenomenon and feeling of what is perpetually vanishing.
I am kept tropical birds a boy. And when you asked me to be in conversation with you about this book, it had, to use your word and run your word, a slightly uncanny effect. because birds really were the passion of my, after my parents, they were the passion of my youth. And not unlinked to what you've been saying, because there are two bits to this in the way I remember to reconstruct it. One is periods of time spent watching through the window of my home, birds landing on the lawn and flying away, and being really perplexed by this and rather thrilled by it. Because, of course, you couldn't control them, but you never knew what would arrive, and you never knew how long would be there. Of course, it's not difficult to re-describe the psychoanalytically, but the experience was rather different from the possible interpretations of it. And I can remember, as a boy, going into woods near where I lived, and just sitting in the woods, and I think probably lots of people have this experience, which is, to begin with, there's nothing there. And the more absorbed you get into it, it's full of noises and creatures and so on. Which is, of course, in a way not unlike or analogous to doing psychoanalysis or just having a conversation with somebody. And I think that, for me, I've kept birds partly as were a false solution to the problem of the fact that they were vanishing, of course, all the time. So I kept tropical birds in an aviary that I had in my garden. And I would spend a long time sort of looking at them. And I was aware that there were two kinds of birds. In a way, there were the birds that vanished and the birds that didn't. But of course, there's a limit to the access you have even to the captured creature. And of course, you are imprisoning it and they do die. But there was something about the way in which you described, just very briefly, a couple retire, they move to Seaford where you actually do live, and gradually they are persecuted by the sound of the gulls. I grew up in Cardiff, which is a port. There were loads of gulls, of course, all the time, still are. And again, another strange thing, which is the way in which, I remember when I was read literature at university, studying Anglo-Saxon, the Anglo-Saxons believed that the gulls were laughing at them. And it's very interesting, if you remember that, the next time you hear a gull, because they could be thought of as laughing at us, but clearly they aren't laughing at us. But nevertheless, the proximity of these birds, which were in a way very, very remote, and when you're close to a gull, they're huge. And they're scavengers, and so they've got a feeling of being sort of feral, as it were, feral children and so on. So they collect a lot. And yet, it seems to me you're very keen in the writing of this book to imagine what it would be like to live in a world in which one didn't or couldn't anthropomorphize them. As though this is a relationship thwarted by linguistic description.
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to your earlier comment, and I think it's true. I mean, I'm trying to think about the double meaning of bird watching. I am trying to think about birds watching as well as watching birds. And it is, in part, a novel about anthropomorphism and what we might think of or hope are the limits of anthropomorphism, but perhaps also the uncertainty around that question of limits. And in some respects, it seems to me the impossibility of having any confidence about where anthropomorphism stops. And that, for me, connects up with psychoanalysis in fundamental ways, because, you know, I've been reading in writing this summer and enjoying it immensely. And one of the things that book talks about, which all of your work, I suppose, engages with in one way or another, is a sort of turning on its head of Freud's know thyself, to say, you know, it's really about getting into a situation where you need not know. Which is no doubt, you know, somewhat, there are affinities with negative capability.
Yeah.
Keats' idea of being in mysteries, doubts, and uncertainties.
But anthropomorphism seems to me to be something that one can only think about with some experience of that kind of uncertainty, if one's being critical and reflective about it. And the, I suppose the, you know, I'm still trying to think about this, but, you know, I'm happy to hear you say that there's wordplay in the novel because, you know, I guess there is. But in a sense, I don't think I invent any words at all, but I do kind of propose one neologism, which is ornithomorphism.
Yeah.
And ornithomorphism is not in the OED, but it does seem to me to be a potentially valuable word for trying to think about the ways in which birds have shaped our language. So on the one hand, we have all these kind of experiences of impossibility, really. And, you know, is it laughing? What language do we use? There is no proper language to describe the sounds of herring gulls or other birds. And then, on the other hand, or on the other wing, you know, there's the ways in which birds actually inspire,
yeah.
And give wings to what we say. As far as that word psyche and the idea of flight as well as the soul.
I suppose for me, the risk would be, I'm not saying you're saying this, but the risk would be to think in this case of birds as kind of evocative objects, as though the fact there happen to be birds in the world we live in is like an inducement to words. It's like a provocation of language. And it seems to me what's very, very difficult is to believe that one is, in a sense, in a world that is of a piece with birds that doesn't require language. You know what I mean? That there's a way of coexisting with this fact that doesn't require linguistic description. I mean, Virginia Woolf says, nothing happens until it is described. And Winnicott says that, for him at least, one of the most important experiences in psychoanalysis is what he calls ticking over, non-purposive states. And they're often described as states in which there's no talking. So this would be one way of kind of formulating this dilemma, if it is that, which is on the one hand, things become real by being described. On the other hand, the sense in which language can be a refuge or a way of preempting experiences that are, as it were, pre-linguistic. And this seems to be one of the things that's being worked out and through with in your book. Do you think that's right?
Yeah, I mean, it's what I am constantly wrestling with, if that's the right word. I mean, I find it completely intimidating. I invent this character called Silas Woodlock. You know, in a way, you know, the novel begins with being woken up by seagulls. And, I mean, some people here perhaps live in the vicinity of seagulls and are familiar with this
racket.
Cacophony. Which is crazy, and it comes before dawn. And I found myself writing something in that hypnagogic state about the craziness of being woken up before I wanted to be woken up by this, you know, incredible diversity of sounds, because it's not just laughing, it's not just whinnying, it's not just screeching, you know, it's incredibly varied. So it really is a kind of challenge. How are you going to, what kind of notation could you possibly come up with? And writing a few pages of this, and then thinking, well, this isn't me, but who might be the person who's being the I here?
Yeah.
And that's really where Silas comes from. And the whole of the novel comes out of that, those few pages. And then the hides in the second part of the novel are an attempt to, in one way or another, engage with that otherness which you've referred to without violence, but
yeah.
But of course knowing that that's virtually impossible to do.
Yeah. When you were talking about that, and I had this memory when I was reading the Hides section of the book, there's a story that is told about John Cage, which people you may know, which is that somebody went to interview Cage when he lived in the Chelsea Hotel, and he composed music there. And the interviewer went in, started talking to Cage, and at a certain point, car alarms kept going off all the time in the street. And the interviewer said to Cage, "Doesn't this drive you mad that you're working and presumably concentrating, and every so often these car alarms go off?" And Cage said, "No, I think of them as sound sculpture." And it seemed to me a very interesting, moment or way of thinking about something that is initially thought of as a persecution and then is re-described in a way that really radically, magically changes the description. And if you do this as an experiment, the next time you're in a building and a car alarm goes off and drives you mad, think of it as sound sculpture. And it sometimes has an effect. And it seems to me what it catches on to, what the story catches on to, I think, and I think this is very much an extraordinary, I think, sort of meditation in a way, that is the second half of the book, called Hides, and the interesting ambiguity of the word, is something to do with the privacy of experience that need not be solipsistic. That you can think of character, so to speak, as opaque, but not incommunicado, or present without needing to articulate itself in a certain sense. And I think Hides, in the way it mulls over that, I mean, perhaps we should, if you don't mind, I'll read them, because it might just give a clue of this, because some of these are absolutely extraordinary.
You're not going to be the chickens, are you? I've never actually read The Chickens aloud, and
I'm not sure anybody could take it.
Well, it has to go through different modulations and different voices, I suppose. It ends up very military. But
if you don't mind, I'll read. I'll just read one briefly, if you don't mind, and then we can open up to the audience. They're in sections. This is Hyde 12. Thomas Hardy remembers, when he was about 4 years old, quote, being in the garden at Bockhampton with his father on a bitterly cold winter day. They noticed a field fare half frozen, and his father took up a stone idly and threw it at the bird, possibly not meaning to hit it. The field fare fell dead, and the child Thomas picked it up, and it was as light as a feather, all skin and bone, practically starved. He said he'd never forgotten how the body of the field fare felt in his hand. The memory had always haunted him. End of quote. This is one of the last things that Hardy is thought to have written, dictating the words to his second wife. It is a near-death recollection of earliest childhood. What is going on in this confession to having been haunted all one's life by the memory of the body of a bird? The ghost of a bird in the hand. It is perhaps to this memory that Hardy pays a bleak homage in his novel The Hand of Ethelberta, when he describes his heroine's response to an unpleasant practical joke. Quote, Ethelberta might have fallen dead with the shock, so terrible and hideous was it. She neither shrieked nor fainted, but no poor January field fare was ever colder, no ice house more dank with perspiration than she was then. End of quote. But here the field fare has already been snapped up, subordinated within the machine-like functioning of comparative metaphor, along with the ice house. The sense of melodrama, the stagey dark comedy in the hyperbolic terrible and hideous, and the anthropomorphic perspiration, is quite different from the tone, a of Hardy's childhood reminiscence about the fall of the field hare and the feeling of it as light as a feather in his hand, all skin and bone. Such experiences may come in early years or in later life. A hide could also be a name for this kind of memory, a fugitive place, an experience altering with each visitation, a haunt of remembrance that watches over who we are or might become. Amazing. So do ask questions and feel free not to.
At the centre of this book is who actually wrote the story of the girls, and you leave it quite quite ambiguous. It could have been either of the Eccles Royals, it could actually have been Silas. Was Silas channeling somebody? Because there seems to be a time issue here, that he finds the story in a second-hand bookshop not that long after he loses the script, or maybe I've missed the passage of time. I was wondering whether you were trying to make some comment about sort of the mutability of who really is the author, and does it matter, is it really in the eyes of the reader rather than the writer?
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, for clarification, perhaps I could say there are primarily two Nicholas Royals. There is also a third, but the third Nicholas Royal, he doesn't have a significant role in the novel, but he does exist. He's an academic at the University of Exeter. Very, very nice chap. Met him. And you know, he did his PhD on the parenting behaviour of gulls at Durham in 1998. So it was a very bizarre coincidence to find a third Nicholas Royal also very interested in birds, because the other Nicholas Royal, who teaches creative writing at Manchester Metropolitan University, has a very long-standing interest in birds, and indeed he synchronised the publication of an English guide with the appearance of his latest book, which is called Ornithology, which is a collection of 16 stories about birds, some of which are discussed in an English guide because they've been published in magazines and so forth down the years. So there is this second Nicholas Royal who is real, you know, as I am, and he is a writer. He's published 7 novels, and Ozma, this character in the book, talks about that Nicholas Royal's work and talks about this Nicholas Royal's work, and because we have been confused for years, okay, I mean, confused by each other and with each other, inevitably, you know, we can't not be attached in something. And in the book on the uncanny, the book called The Uncanny from 2003, it's actually a photo of us giving a fiction reading in Southampton in 1999. So we go back quite a long way. And occasionally, as in the case of a book called Murmurations, an anthology of short stories, uncanny short stories about birds, he was editing this and he asked me if I would write a story for it. So that's where Gulls is published. Okay. I recommend Murmurations as a book. All the royalties go to the RSPB. Don't have a copy of Murmurations, it's a lovely volume, but
Yeah, I mean, Silas Woodlock discovers this book in a second-hand bookshop a year after it's been published. He is the person who wrote Gulls. He's the eye in that story. And the novel is about, as it were, my discovering that it's Silas Woodlock and finding out who Silas Woodlock is. And I guess that's where it kind of links up in some ways with that Forster essay again, because, you know, one of the things that Forster says in Anonymity is literature wants not to be signed. And this is something that has really kind of fascinated me for a long time. This idea that, you know, you might need to put a name on something, or there's the desire for the imposition of a name, but there is something about literary writing that wants not to be signed. And that was something that I was trying to think about also with Woodlock and the question of plagiarism, I suppose. I don't know, does that clarify?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. There's so many things I would like to engage you on in conversation. I came along armed with all these quotations that I was going to throw at you. Perhaps that will have to wait for another occasion.
I think it might, yeah.
You talked about the dark elements of the book, but when I read it, I found it immensely... do you need this? Can you hear me? Immensely funny. And also, sort of, it felt very entertaining in a way that was all cinematic or filmic, in some sections of it, and some sections weren't, and you have Libby working in film. When you were writing of it, did you think, could I adapt this for, you know, film, television at some point, or was it something that, because of the wordplay that Adam's talked about, might be impossible?
Yeah, I think I've given up any hope that any of my books would ever be filmed. you know, I thought of Quilt as something that's very visual,
very.
But I thought it was interesting to write about cinema, to write about what Lily calls cinematic intention, to think about the relationship between Daphne du Maurier's The Birds and Hitchcock's film, and what it means to know them both, and how difficult it is actually if you've read the story, which I think is a very powerful piece of writing, to then see the film and, you know, separate the two out, or not have interference or a kind of conversation between the two going on. Nobody's approached me for film rights, and I'm not expecting it. But the question of amusement, I mean, I was saying to Adam before we got up on this little podium that, you know, there have been some very nice reviews of the novel, and then one kind of stinker, which unfortunately is in The Guardian, which is a paper that I love. And, you know, I was saying to Adam, you know, in some ways the novel is a love letter to The Guardian. And The Guardian kind of appears all over the place in it. And my obituary, indeed, appears in The Guardian. That's a bit of a spoiler, isn't it? But this review, it's by a woman that, you know, I've never met. I don't know anything about her. But it's the coldest, meanest review any of my works have ever received. And you know, there isn't really a positive word to be found anywhere in the... I measured it, it's 18 inches. apart from the word comic. She actually refers to it as a comic novel. And I wonder, is this a parapraxis? Did she actually, you know, did she mean that? Or did she, should she have excised that word? But I do hope that it is also funny. Yeah. I mean, I hope it's funny, but it's also really, for me, it's, you know, about these things that we've been talking about. And so there's plenty of seriousness too.
I haven't read the novel yet, but it seems as you've been talking that there's a lot of kind of bigger concepts about literature and communication and kind of how we experience things, and I just wondered if you might say a bit about how much you think about those things when you're actually engaged in the process of writing. Is that something that you kind of consciously put in as you're working on a book?
Well, I think it's impossible to write something like a novel or a piece of fiction without, certainly for me, without being aware of something that Adam talks about in his new book, in writing, and in some ways in writing seems to me to be about, which is the devaluation of literature. The kind of, I don't know how you might want to describe this yourself, but the way in which literature has been so kind of secondarized or sidelined in our culture. And to go back to, you know, the very first topic we were talking about this evening, you know, I love words, I love language, I love books, I love novels and poetry and plays, and I teach these things with passion. So, of course, it informs what I'm doing. But I'm not that. That's not, you know. I think when I'm writing, I need to be as unconscious as possible, I suppose. I mean, if I could do it in my sleep, I would, but I can't. You know, as close as I can get.
But you just mentioned about having a negative review and how you felt about that.
Yeah.
And I'm quite intrigued by Stephen Osborne going to the conference. I mean, I'm only early in the book.
Yeah.
About the double whammy.
Yeah.
Where there are two men on the stage and someone in the audience says, you wouldn't know of powerful writing if it smacked you in the face with a brick. And, you know, I found it very interesting. I'd just like to say I found it very interesting tonight, both of you on the stage, but I'm just intrigued, because that is a very negative comment that you put in the book.
Yeah.
Somebody in the audience is throwing at the people on the stage, and of course the whole conference goes quiet.
Yeah.
And I'm just intrigued, you know, sort of, in a way, I suppose, how would you react in a conference if somebody said that to you? And I'm not saying it by the way. Yeah.
Well, you know, I was in that conference. That is the novel. One of the events actually that I did earlier in the summer, just after publication, was with the, I don't know how to refer to them, the main other Nicholas Royal, the Manchester Nicholas Royal, was to go to the Burgess Foundation, which is in the novel, and to do an event with the two of us, chaired by Matthew Frost, who's in the novel, an event that hadn't happened before the novel. And I spent the whole period of this event just kind of, you know, anticipating, apprehending the thought that somebody in the audience that they didn't. I really love Kafka for all sorts of reasons. But one of the things that I find very preoccupying and dazzling about Kafka, and which I
which I discover in a quite consistent way in teaching Kafka. So I teach a short story or whatever it might be. Two or three times a year I will have a seminar on a Kafka text. And I am consistently amazed by the way in which Kafka's texts seem to be able to read their readers. So that what somebody says about a Kafka text is in some ways far more obviously revealing about them than it is about the text. And, you know, there are different ways in which we can categorize what Kafka is doing and think, you know, analyze it and think about it. And obviously the notion of the parable is in some ways suggestive. Though not perhaps essential, but I'm really interested in the idea of texts that provoke and in some ways invite a reader to find themselves in a text as they perhaps haven't before. And that would include thinking about what we understand by powerful writing. So it's a question which the novel is posing and attempting to reflect on, but only in an oblique way.
Harry Berger, just with the time, is it? Harry Berger, the Shakespeare critic, tells a story about teaching Shakespeare in which he says, I spent years trying to sort of work out, you know, what I thought about the characters. And then it dawned on me that actually what Shakespeare is most interesting about in his soliloquies is what people think about themselves. That it's actually much more interesting what people in Shakespeare think about themselves than what the other characters and the reader thinks about them. One of the really extraordinary and uncanny things about An English Guide, for me, is that it's like a book that is thinking with and about itself all the time. So you find yourself reading sentences that might be thoughts or misgivings or additions that you felt later on in the book. So that your question about, you know, what would it be like were such a thing happen? In reading the book, I certainly found that all the time, it's as though the book was reflecting on itself in a very unusual and strange way. So that you thought things like that, because obviously, sitting here doing this, I could have quoted that bit. Here are two men talking about a book. And in a way, and there are lots of bits, both explicit bits and allusions to what people are doing when they're talking about literature. But the book, in a way, is very strange and provocative in the way it both foreshadows thoughts you didn't realize you were having and raises thoughts that seem like useful criticisms of itself. So it's like it isn't like this, but it's like a Platonic dialogue, but with many, many voices in it. So very, very elaborate things are covered in often very, in apparently very simple ways or simple scenarios or dramas. But a lot of what you think about the book is in the book. That's my experience of it. But you didn't know that until you read the book.
Can I just come back on that comment about powerful writing? So, Stephen Osler makes the comment that you wouldn't know powerful writing. But his definition of powerful writing seems to be, unless it's social or political, like Dickens, mm-hmm. it's not powerful writing. Mm-hmm. And yet, to me, that's only one part of literature. There are many other aspects of literature that can be powerful writing. And he seems to have a very narrow view of it. I'm interested in what your definition of powerful writing is.
Yeah, well, I can only humbly invite you to carry on reading it. I am trying to think about that question with every sentence. Obviously there are ways in which Osmer is narrow-minded. And then there are other ways in which it seems to me he's not.
Because in a way, it seems to me your question is a good example of the thing we're talking about. Because we read Osmer, and he's obviously a very intelligent bloke, but of course he's made of words. And we're thinking things like, well, he's very, very arrogant, this is extremely narrow-minded, but we cannot help but be in some kind of conversation with him while we're reading the book, even though he isn't a person, and we're not having a conversation. And that, I think, is one of the ways in which the book works. You find yourself having conversations with these people who are having conversations with each other or with themselves.
This is one of the ways in which, you know, I suppose there's an obvious rapport for me with Adam's work and Adam's attachment to the essay as a form. And I think things that you say about the essay, you know, in lots of different places, including in this new book, are so fecund and thought-provoking. I am, I suppose, in part, I'm not sure I thought of it like this until I read your book in writing this summer, but I suppose I am in part trying to explore the possibilities of something that you you say. I mean, in your book you say the essay is very rarely a fanatical form. And I think that's a profound observation. And Osmer is a fanatic of sorts. Yeah. And so yeah. it is an attempt to do something different with the essay in the context that they are.
One of the things I think you write very interestingly about is the moment or the period in which people suddenly become fanatical, in which they go from being manifestly ordinary, nice, sensible people to become fanatical, as though there's a kind of latent fundamentalism in people that can be ignited. And that's very interesting in these books.
I don't like to interrupt the conversation. I wonder whether it should be drawn to a close, unless there's one burning question, or if you wanted to make any.
I think it's a shame this can't be a sort of Quaker meeting. We can't sit here for sort of 4 hours and then just people speak or don't speak when they want to.
Well, we could.
We could, but unfortunately I have to go.
Would anyone like... Why not? I mean, if not, then I think... I mean, we'll totally... What are you going to do about all the people who put they want a bird-watching book on their Christmas and end up with a novel? That'd be quite good for you.
Even better.
Well, you know, this was a big issue for the publisher, Candida, who's here. You know, the sales team, the reps or whatever, they insisted that there be this splat on the top right corner. Saying a novel. In my local bookshop in Seaford, my cousin, who's a GP, had not bought the book, and I upbraided him and told him that he had to. So we walked up the street to Sussex Station where there was a copy for sale, and I stood behind him as he went up to purchase it. And the woman at the till said, "You know it's not what it looks like." And I was extremely sort of curious and anxious to know what she was then going to say. And she said, "It's a thriller."
Well, it's been a thrilling conversation. It's been an intriguing, fascinating, wide-ranging conversation. I'm certainly intrigued to read the book. But thank you both so much for the kind of thoughtful way that you've conducted the conversation and covered such wide range of topics. And yeah, thank you so much. And of course, if you do want to buy the book, read the book, and also in writing as well as the novel about bird watching, please do so here. I'm also worried about people who want to put on their Christmas list a book by Nicholas Royal, because they might find it in a book as well. But thank you both so much. Thank you.